Do you enjoy birds? Do you enjoy profanity? Do you enjoy books? Does the idea of birds swearing like longshoremen tickle you silly? Then you are the ideal audience for FN Birds, a field guide to identification, the recently released hardcover book adaptation of the Twitter and online sensation. If hilariously sweary birds is what you need and what you crave, then boy, do we have a fucking book for you.
Language.
The birds swear, so it's appropriate for me to swear as well.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
You know, I can eat a page for hours.
Do you want lunch?
You're A, B, C, D, E. G-H-I-J-K-L-M-N-O-P.
I can't talk too long. I gotta poo.
Oh, no, not the bees! Not the bees! Ah!
It's like looking in a mirror, only not.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to the very first episode of Travolta Cage, the podcast about the greatest actors in history. I'm Clint Worthington.
And I am Nathan Rabin.
And joining us for our very first episode, our premiere, if you will, our brand spanking new coat of paint, Scott Weinberg. Thank you so much for joining us, Scott.
Guys, thank you so much. It's always flattering to be invited on onto a podcast, and to be on the first episode. It just made my day. It feels great. Thank you guys so much.
Excellent. Now, you're a podcaster extraordinaire. You're an expert on this particular era as well. Tell the people where they can find your stuff.
Okay, well, mostly you can find me on Twitter at Scott E. Weinberg. I do a podcast with my writing partner, Stephen DeGennaro, and it's called Science versus Fiction. And it's basically a podcast. He's an astrophysicist, and of course, I'm a film critic. So he and I take two sci-fi films and compare them each episode in the arenas of intelligence, scientific intelligence, and entertainment value. And our most recent episode was Outbreak versus Contagion. And we had Steven's brother on, who is an epidemiologist who works in Haiti.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, yeah.
The entire premise sounds like a less strident Neil deGrasse Tyson.
It was inspired by the pedantry of Neil deGrasse Tyson. Because I basically said to Steven, does science, bad science, ever ruin a movie for you? And he says, not if it's a good movie. And I went, boom, we got a show.
Right.
Well, we don't talk about this a lot, but Clint is also an astrophysicist.
I am.
Doesn't come up a whole lot, but you know, he's got the going on for him.
I got my astrophysics degree from the School of Hard Knocks, so it's very a little unconventional. I learned that astrophysics is just another way to rap.
Yeah, well, and but you also did a project somewhat analogous. I need to fucking figure out how to say words before people listen to this podcast. But you did a project somewhat analogous to this about the 1980s. Do you want to talk about that a little bit? I had the pleasure and the honor of being a guest for a Patreon episode of that.
Yeah, we did. My former podcasting partner and I, Drew McWeeny, did a show called 80s All Over. And the workload just became just ridiculously prohibitive. So we had to stop on that. But even though we didn't finish the decade, we did do a large collection of episodes, and I'm really proud. You, of course, were an excellent excellent guest, and you know, it is a little bittersweet, you know, because like you had a show and it ended, and you said, "Oh, I'm bummed that it ended," but oh well, that you know. But ours kind of had like a finish line.
Yeah.
And the fact that we didn't reach it, you know, it was frustrating, but I'm really, really proud of the show that we did. And it's still finding new fans. That's called 80s All Over. So yeah, I had a ball doing that, even though it was more work than any two men could do. We had a lot of fun.
Right. Did it cause you to hate or love the 80s more than you did before?
I'm about the same, but, you know, sometimes you can have too much of a good thing. Let's just put it that way.
Right, right. And did you love the 80s as much as Michael Ian Black, for instance?
Oh, God, no. the thing about the 80s is that, like, I'm nostalgic for the things I think are good. I'm a little bit forgiving of some bad things, but I'm also very, very, you know, honest when it comes to the obnoxiousness of the 80s, of the clothes and the hair and the slang. And there's a lot of stuff about the 80s that does not age well.
You're not talking about Miami Connection, are you? Because that, I think, of everything in the 1980s, ages the best and the most exquisitely.
Yeah, fair enough. And, you know, it's that's an interesting segue into our first film, because it was almost created on the bedrock of slang phrases and odd terminology.
Very true. But before we get into the films themselves, we should explain, since this is episode one, what the podcast is about. Travolta Cage is, you know, for those of you who are carrying over from our previous podcast, Nathan Rabin's Happy Cast, you listened probably to our little interstitial mini-show that we did a couple weeks ago.
I thought it was Happy Cats.
Oh, yes. No, unfortunately. Well, that was the problem. We didn't have enough cats, so we had to guest.
All
so
this
just,
time.
Like, the point. You know?
All this time, I thought it was Nathan cats. Rabin's Happy Cats. And he's going to sell that premise to Netflix and make $1 million.
Well, we're still waiting for that check.
That's my children's show. It's slow going. You know, I got Michael Madsen is the host of it. But for some reason, Netflix isn't interested.
No.
Good luck selling that.
Madsen really loves cats.
I'm just
throwing it out there. You know?
Yeah. Well, he's going to cameo in Tom Hooper's Cats before too long. He'd be a great Mr. Mistopheles. But I digress. Anyway, back to the premise. So John Travolta and Nicolas Cage are two of the most fascinating, deeply crazy cult heroes and weirdos of their generation. And, you know, they're people who are, they're very complex guys, very weird dudes, often problematic. You know, there's, you know, no small amount of controversy around them, I'm sure. But we were very, very interested in figuring out, like, as film actors and as, you know, personalities, they have very interesting, yes, thespians, as makers of a craft. They're very, very interesting figures to look into, especially in terms of where their careers intersect and diverge and the different sort of models and roles they've taken. And especially now in the kind of VOD morass they find themselves in, although Cage is climbing his way back up with weirder stuff like Mandy and things like the upcoming Color Out of Space. So you know, on the heels of, we did a Travolta double feature back on Happy Cast that really piqued our interest. And with the news of a Face Off remake happening, it reminded us that Face Off, I think, might be at least one of our favorite motion pictures. It may not be a perfect motion picture. Maybe it is.
I beg to differ. I think that Face Off is a perfect motion picture. I would say that it's maybe the most perfect picture. And one of the ideas behind this podcast is that actually Face Off was too perfect and too good, and they kind of flew too close to the sun. And God had to punish both of them for making a film that was too good and by forcing them to kind of wander the direct-to-video wilderness for decades
God or
and decades
Xenu
to go.
In Travolta's case.
Exactly. But no, we are definitely of the mindset that Face Off is a perfect motion picture.
To be
too
fair.
Good almost. And that's the thing, too.
I'm going to name an actor of their approximate generation who don't have to, aren't compelled to dip their toe into the VOD, or as we used to call it, direct to video morass.
That is a very good question. And even people who managed to scrap their way out of DTV, like Sylvester Stallone, it seemed like he was there forever, just garbage. And then he had this brilliant idea of recycling all of his popular characters. But even then, it's like Escape Plan 3 is direct to DVD.
Yeah. It's funny that you'd say that, because Stallone is kind of doing his own Disney live action, you know?
Yes. Behold our new streaming service, Stallone Plus.
Right? Instead of resurrecting Aladdin and Lion King and Lady and the Tramp, Stallone's resurrecting Rocky, Rambo, and Cobra Eddie?
I can't wait for Rhinestone, honestly.
This whole idea sounds pretty over the top.
Oh,
but the thing about Travolta and Cage is they made some of the very best movies in the history of film. They've made some of the worst movies in the history of film, and they made some of the best worst movies in the history of film. And even the in-between spaces are fucking fascinating and very much worth exploring on a deeply, deeply pathological, obsessive level. I kind of see this as a bit of a sequel to The Weird According to Al, where I spent 3 years writing about every single Weird Al album.
Just because I'm here and we have to throw in the tangent, best album In 3D?
In 3D or Dare to be Stupid.
Or Dare to be Stupid.
Those
okay.
Two are, yeah, they kind of got the Nicolas Cage, John Travolta, golden radiant youth thing. You know, you're never as beautiful or pure as you are when you're young. And I think that's right. True of Weird Al Yankovic as much as...
Yeah, it's just fascinating to me of... They could be, you know, kind of just like a movie star actor or a real actor, and I think they're both real good actors in certain things. And they, when you hit a certain age, it seems like you are remanded to all of a sudden you look down and go, oh, a Stallone movie I've never heard of because it went straight to video, or, you know, and I think, does that stigma still exist as much as it used to, or do people look down on actors who have been remanded to the VOD arena?
I think there's a certain class of VOD movie that they ascribe to, like in the same with your John's Cusack and your Adrian's Brody. That, I mean, I think there's a difference between like independent film and then the kind of VOD stuff that you tend to see, like your Poison Roses, for instance. But then, you know, they also swing for the fences with stuff that works, like Mandy, and stuff that really doesn't, like Gotti. And I think part of the podcast goal is to look at those differences, see what works and what doesn't work, and what sets these two men apart, and also what makes them eerily similar.
Yeah, very much so.
It's like looking in a mirror, only not.
What I like is that, like, you can sense when somebody kind of hits that VOD segment of their career. And a lot of times it's, okay, you're at this point where you're taking these quick, low-budget, foreign-made films for money, for a quick paycheck. But even within that realm, it seems like Cage has a little bit of quality control that other actors in that arena don't always have. Mm-hmm. Like, not quality control, but chooses interesting concepts, chooses interesting projects, even on the B-movie level.
Right, whereas Travolta, I'm sure if he had that sense of taste, I suppose, would be able to exert a similar kind of quality control, but because he's a batshit nuts Scientologist, he doesn't really like get that even these like big swing for the fences ideas really don't work. Case in point, The Fanatic.
Well, and he takes very big swings, and The Fanatic is fucking fascinating to me because it's so wrong, and it's so wrong on every level, and I remember people just salivating for it months and months and months before it came out, and just they were so, the schadenfreude, you could just feel it dripping from the whole world, and it just lived up to every element of it. And I feel like in a weird way, he's kind of Reaganing now, because he's making these movies like Gotti and like The Fanatic that are bad on a transcendent level, bad in a way that, like, you know, he made maybe the worst film of the year two times in a row, if you can throw out Laquisha. In a way, that's almost as impressive as Nicolas Cage having this amazing comeback and making a series of pretty great fucking movies. Mandy, certainly one. Mom and Dad, I thought was fantastic. Voiceover stuff and Spider-Man and Teen Titans go to the movies. So yeah, they're both there swinging constantly, and they're both out there in a way that's kind of fascinating and unrelenting and ubiquitous.
I think that's what we're seeing in this. Nicolas Cage, to me, is not only one of my favorite actors, but he's a really interesting case study because, you, like you said, it's not always easy to come back from that VOD arena, or at least it used to not be. But he had a great year last year. I mean, like, he did a major voice in Spider-Verse, and that was one of the most beloved movies of the year. It's a great movie. And then I'm like, I loved hearing him in that movie, and then I would go home and watch something like Primal.
Yeah, right. And he's even doing more respectful stuff like the documentary Love Antosha, where he reads out entries from Anton Yelchin's diary, and it's somehow strangely one of his best performances in years, just like embodying this younger actor with so much promise who could have turned out to sort of be as like wild and experimental as Cage was, and it's really, really interesting. Now, while we have yet to totally go through the actual like nuts and bolts of the premise, which is, over the course of this podcast, this sort of 4 or 5 year project that's probably going to happen, we're going through all of John Travolta and Nicolas Cage's filmography in chronological order, roughly. So, like, you know, for example, there are movies that they've done before the two movies we've done here, but they weren't major enough to really make a good, a spicy first episode.
Or so rather, they did
Devil's Reign.
They did not have a big
walk on.
Yeah, we do not want to waste Scott's time or your time, Clint, watching movies that are fucking terrible. And also, John Travolta is only in it for 1 minute. Again, did we establish that the purpose of this whole podcast is to determine who is better and that there are a very scientific, rigorous process? A lot of voting is involved. Please join our Patreon. And at the end of this 5-year journey, we will have a objective, scientific, irrefutable winner. And it's going to be John Travolta. I know it's a spoiler. It seems wrong. It seems like Nicholas.
Not if I have anything to say about it. Episode.
That's the funny thing. When we first announced this project, because we were developing this project, and we were like, "Oh, this will be an interesting sort of discussion." And I feel like everyone's coming down pretty squarely on the side of Paige. So it's going to be a really kind of an uphill battle.
Yeah, and I feel like I'm going to be Travolta's advocate.
Perhaps. I think on that note, I do kind of want to get a quick little disclaimer out of the way, because this is a question that came up in the sort of development of the podcast process and sort of hearing about it. I just want to point out that, like, as we go through Travolta Cage, our discussion of their careers and performances and all that is not in any way an endorsement of their personal behavior, because there are things like Travolta and participation in Scientology and sexual assault allegations. They've both got their fair share of skeletons in the closet. And, you know, Nathan and I talked about this, and I just think, like, we're not really equipped to litigate that kind of stuff. And so I do think in this case in particular, it's really best to just sort of, like, you know, I hate to say it, but we're going to be kind of separating the art from the artist a little bit here.
Yeah, we will be talking about the movies and the performances and not the human beings.
Yeah, I mean, Drew and I came across that back when we did 80s All Over, which is how often can we explain why people have a problem with Woody Allen or Bill Cosby? Like, that, do we have to do this full disclaimer every single time? Or can we just for the sake of just the show, focus on the films? And it's, you know, it's not always easy, but that's what we're, you know, you're not here to talk about their personal lives. That would be a different podcast.
You know, we are not valorizing them as human beings. You know, that we fully admit that they have done, that Travolta especially has done crappy things. That's all we can really say. That disclaimer out of the way. Let's move on to our first two films. And Nathan, what are we covering this week?
Sure. The first two films that we'll be covering this week are Valley Girl, Martha Coolidge's lovely, lovely 1983 teen romantic comedy, and Carrie, Brian De Palma's vicious, gory, incredibly bloody, iconic 1976 horror movie, which was John Travolta's first big performance, if you do not include The Devil's Reign, and nobody does, because that movie is hot fucking garbage. Although, Scott, have you seen The Devil's Reign?
Cotter. Was Cotter before this?
That was 75. Yeah. It started up in 75, so he's probably around the same time.
Oh, gotcha.
So yeah, I think it was kind of the boom of it was sort of him being a teen heartthrob and a teeny bopper icon. And this is both the perfect and the completely wrong role of that stage of his career.
Right. So yeah, we will definitely get through to those. But again, like Nathan said, if you want to help us out, go to our Patreon at patreon.com/TravoltaCage. Unlike Happy Cast, we will actually be putting effort into the Travolta Cage Patreon. We will be giving you exclusive, you know, podcast segments and things like that. We'll answer questions, all that kind of stuff.
I have a newsletter called Reading This Won't Bring Back Your Honey that I'm very, very proud of. I just wrote my first entry, which is about how you should not vote against John Travolta if you think that he's basically playing himself in Battlefield Earth. And that even though that's a very, very real, a very authentic, a performance with a lot of verisimilitude, he was an actor playing a role. He's not actually an evil space alien. Although the fact that he belongs to an evil space alien cult doesn't speak well on that front, I gotta admit.
No, not at all. So yeah, please help us out at patreon.com/TravoltaCage. We're very encouraged by the response we've gotten so far. We've gotten quite a few new patrons since the shift, which is really nice. So keep them coming. Thank you so, so much for helping out.
Ow, dang me, how could you?
For sure. Besides, it's totally gnarly birth control.
I can't stand it.
Okay, so he's awesome.
Valley Girl.
She's out there somewhere.
This is the story of a boy from Hollywood who never dreamed the girl he'd want most was down here.
I'll stop the world.
Hello.
Hello. Who invited you?
Oh, wow, you mean you have to be invited? That explains it.
What?
Well, everyone is dressed weird. See, if I had been invited, I would have known this was a costume party.
Right.
It's the story of a girl from the valley who never dreamed she'd ever be seen with a boy from over here.
It's like I'm not getting out of this car.
All right, but when they attack the car, save the radio.
So when can I see you again?
I'm here with you now.
I know.
This is the story of Randy and Julie, the way they come together. The people who try to pull them apart.
Like, don't you think they have parties over there? Oh, where? At the zoo?
This geek that she's with could scar her for life.
God, for life?
If you think she's confused, you should see her father.
I'm together now. Be right there.
Randy's hot. She's from the valley. He's not. Valley girl.
Oh, bitchin', is this in 3D?
No, but your face is.
Let's get started with Valley Girl. Nathan, what is Valley Girl about?
Sure. Valley Girl was a fascinatingly overachieving 1983 low-budget comedy rooted in a fad, a linguistic fad of the early 1980s, a Valley Girl slang. And it was kind of popularized on a national level by Frank Zappa. and every once in a while I think to myself, should I get into Frank Zappa? Have I not given him enough of a chance? And then I played the YouTube clip of a Valley Girl and I'm like, this dude fucking hates everybody. And he recorded this song, Valley Girl, as an expression of his hatred of everybody, specifically, you know, sort of upper middle class girls who speak in a ditzy, distinctive way. And so I guess Moon Unit Zappa, she took a bunch of meetings to turn Valley Girl into a movie. And they didn't go anywhere, but somewhere, you know, somebody had an idea to make a movie. It's kind of make a Valley Girl version of Romeo and Juliet, starring Deborah Foreman, a very charming actress, and a new actor, the nephew of Francis Ford Coppola, a guy named Nicolas Cage. So popular Valley Girl slang that everybody loves to hear includes like so bitching, gag me with a spoon, grody to the max, I am so sure, and barf me out. And that is the language, the lingo of our heroine and her friends. And their lives change when they see a hunk running along on the beach, you know, while they're sunning themselves one afternoon. And that hunk is Nicolas Cage. Do you guys want to talk a little bit about the way that he is introduced here?
He's a total hunkosaurus. Like, it's a very Daniel Craig in Casino Royale kind of moment, which is interesting. It's a disarming way to introduce him, especially as we find out he's a punk later, because like that's the central. Those are the two houses, both alike in dignity, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's the Valley Girls and the punks, and
Montague versus Capulet. Now it's what you watch the film now, and you're like, what about them is different? I don't get it.
Yeah,
but
right.
But well, trust us, back then. The punk and the Valley Girl were polar opposites.
Different worlds.
Well, I think that that's part of what's fascinating is the uniform is what differentiates them. You know, the punks dress the way they have since 1977. You know, they all dress like Joey Ramone and Johnny Rotten. And the Valley Girls, you know, they live for fashion. Although I got to say, even for... some of the fashion choices here are pretty perverse. It seemed like Deborah Foreman seems to be wearing like a house coat for part of the movie. She also sleeps with a horrifying, hideous mime doll. Did either of you guys notice the horrible nightmare-inducing mime doll that she's seen?
I missed that, but maybe that was like my brain trying to protect me from something that, horrifying.
That was part of the thing of the Valley Girl and the 80s in general was. Every single open space must be covered by an accoutrement or a what's it called when you have a just little tchotchkes, affectations, toys, jewelry, everything, every inch of the frame must be filled.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed, indeed. And so, yeah, there is this. I mean, it's also the height of like 80s commercialism and excess. And obviously, this is taking place in the Tishler Valley in California. And so, like, you know, everyone's very sort of upper middle class. And there is this, you know, it's like mall culture and youth culture and everything intersecting. And so there is this, you know, ditziness and, you know, the trappings of high school life. But what sets Valley Girl apart, this is the first time I've seen it, was for this podcast, is how sort of sensitive and surprisingly sweet it is.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And I think
it's not talking down to Valley Girls or anybody, totally. Really.
But it also has this, there's so many wonderful elements of it, one of which is that it embraces the concept of aggressive female sexuality. I feel like in any other teen sex comedy of this era, you know, they would be judged for wanting to fuck, wanting to have sex. But the idea here is that you can be sexual. You can be aggressive. You can have choices. And one of the things that's fascinating to me about Nicolas Cage's introduction is that he's so objectified. He's so sexualized. He is the romantic love interest here. And one of the things that's interesting to me is that that changes over the course of the film. And for the first two acts, you know, the Valley Girl is our heroine, and we see the world through her eyes. And then in the third act, we see things through Randy's eyes. Yeah, and he is a weirdly romantic figure. He does not try to have sex with her, which I thought was, yeah, passes for the height of chivalry in a movie like this.
That's what he kind of plays to me like he was written as if he was a more chivalrous Fonzie. In 1983.
I can see that. A Gorch-type figure. So they fall in love at first sight at a party, and he just has to have her, and he will not accept no, and then they fall in love.
And here's the thing, though. Yes. Like, he doesn't accept no, but because he thinks that, like, he's picked up on the vibe that she is sort of consenting to it, too. So there's, like, these things that on the surface would maybe read as creepy behavior, especially now, but, like, they read as really sweet. And even like the extended comedic bit where he hides out in the shower at the party, which is a great extended bit, because it's like, yeah, he's waiting for Julie to come in, but he has to sit through hours of all these other people like fumbling and making out and doing drugs and like arguing.
Well, that's
and
such a great element so of social bored. Satire to it as well, this idea of, you know, this is California in the 1980s. It's like the most American place in the world. So they fall in love to Modern English's Melt With You. And I gotta say, this is one of the best uses of music in the history of the universe. Like, I was fascinated to find out that Melt With You only like made it to like 83 on the pop charts. Mm. Because I think of that as like the most popular song of all time. And it's so perfect for advertising, for trailers, for movies. And yeah, this is, again, this is one of those rare movies where you feel like these characters are actually falling in love, and this is a substantive thing, and they really deserve each other, and they really want each other. But, you know, the world of high school is terrible. And one of the themes of this, and also Carrie, is this idea of peer pressure and conformity being these monstrous, nightmarish, evil entities that bring out the worst in people and cause them to betray their better aspects. And here, that means that Julie breaks up with Randy so that she can be popular. And she can go to the prom with the popular guy, and that she doesn't have to leave her social circle. She doesn't have to question the world or her place in it. And this is, I think, an illustration where I feel like Cage might be too sexy and too appealing and too wonderful, because you're like, why on earth would she not want to be with him? He's so wonderful, and her friends, you know, while they're also depicted with a lot of sensitivity and a lot of care, you know, they can't compare to the titanic, volcanic sexual force that is a young Nicolas Cage here.
Among the friends, I want to just throw out some love for E.G. Daly, who is a spark plug in this movie. Most people would know her as Dottie from Pee-wee's Big Adventure, but she is a voice actor, singer, character actor, and she's just an 80s icon, and I adore her.
Yeah, and Tommy Pickles.
And Michael Bowen, who plays her ex-boyfriend, who is just like the meathead hunk dummy. And Michael Bowen plays him. He's a simply written character, but Michael Bowen plays him perfectly. He is.
Yeah. He plays him like the main character of his own story, but like.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Right, and we have not, speaking of people who are fantastic, who we have not talked about yet, her parents, the Valley Girl, Julie's parents are played by Frederick Forrest and Colleen Camp, who are wonderful, wonderful character actors, I'm sure you are familiar with. And Frederick Forrest might be one of my favorite cinematic dads of all time. He's just this sweetheart of a guy, as my people would call, he's a real mensch.
Can you guys name any other moment in which can you guys name another movie in which Frederick Forrest is, like, sweet?
I don't know.
He nails it here.
The parents should have... If this movie, if Valley Girl was a TV show, I want these parents to get a spinoff. That's how great they are.
I want to see them run their health food store and be generally accepting of their Valley Girl daughter.
And there's this lovely, lovely moment where Julie is about to go to the prom. And it's this big, big moment for her dad. It's like, you know, letting go. It's this big milestone. So to commemorate it and to calm his nerves, he like goes into the closet and gets really stoned. And Deborah Foreman has this wonderful, wonderful moment where she's just kind of expressing through body language, like, I know you're high. You're not fooling anybody. It doesn't fucking matter to me. I'm not judging you or anything, but I know that you are baked, you know, because this is this big moment. There's also a wonderful sort of subplot involving Colleen Camp. And her sexual hunger for much, much younger men that is, again, handled with sensitivity, handled with a complete lack of judgment. You know, and there's a sexiness to this movie that, you know, you don't really see in teen movies these days.
Yeah, what I also love is that there are broad, like, kind of caricatures of, for example, the parents or the ex-boyfriend. Nobody in this film is, like, hated. There's no... They're, like, in subsequent, like, what we call teen sex comedies, the ex-boyfriend becomes a rotten, like, a one-note caricature, and the parents become hippie buffoons. But in this movie, the director likes every character in this movie.
Yeah, because, like, I think the shittiest thing that Michael Bowen's character does is try to sleep with Lauren, right? But even that sort of failed, and it's also because Julie broke up with him out of a relatable sort of impulse, and I think the movie sort of sees it for what it is. I don't know, it's very, very interesting.
There's just, for a movie that is often lumped in with a lot of bad teen sex comedies, this one has an actual heart to it. It really does. It's not just cynical or just comedy. It actually is. There's a bit of sincerity there.
Right. And another thing, going back to the parents, one thing that I picked up on somehow that struck out to me is that, like, for a little bit, I couldn't tell who was the parents and who were the kids. Because, like, Colleen Camp looks just as young as everyone else. And, like, the parents at the party, I had to, like, find out as a reveal that, like, two of the characters were, like, the mom and dad. And, like, who are you? You look like classmates.
I had that big time with Carrie where, like, all of the teenagers are played by these super sexy future stars. And a 31-year-old Edie McClurg.
Yeah.
why is somebody approaching 40 still in high school?
Yeah,
that was less of a problem for me here. But yeah, we sort of talked about things that should be creepy but are less creepy because they're done with charm and sensitivity. After Julie breaks up with Randy, he goes out of his way to win her back. He will not take no for an answer. There is a trope that you see in a lot of teen comedies, a lot of romantic comedies in general, which is to get the person back, they somehow seem to show up everywhere the object of their desire is, often while working. They'll like go to the movie theater and he's working at the movie theater. They'll go to the drive-in, he's working at the drive-in. And I wonder how the fuck does he manage this? It seems like such a waste of time to go and get these jobs on the off chance that you can run into Julie and have her be like, no.
Yeah, the whole process, you know, you got to go, you got to apply for the job. We'll call you back in a couple of days. Well, wait, she's supposed to go to the movies tomorrow night. Shit, hire me right away.
It's like going through the interview. I can't help but notice you've gone through a lot of jobs in the last couple of months.
Well, it's only because I'm stalking this girl, and wherever she likes to go, I go and get a job there.
You're hired.
It says here that your professional ambitions are to attain Julia at any cost.
That's a trope.
It's on the objective line on his resume.
I'm glad that that trope has kind of is dying now.
Yeah.
You see it in a lot of films of this era, and that trope is, oh, girl said no, don't give up. I would never have married my wife if I had given up after the first try. It's not good advice, man.
Yeah,
not good.
It's not
good advice. It wasn't then, and it's not now. Okay.
Well, I feel like the old paradigm would be that if you love somebody, you will stop at nothing and you will not accept no and you will go on and on and on. And now, thank God, it's if somebody says no, respect that. That is a legitimate, authentic answer. They have their fucking reasons. They don't need you to show up outside their window at 3 a.m. That's called being a stalker.
Right. You know, and the point of that argument is let the girl know that you are sincere and you are not a perv and you are, you know, want to just get to know her better and you really sincerely like her. That's what that means. That doesn't mean ask her out every day for 7 days until she says, if you leave me alone, fine.
Right. Yeah. And I guess one thing sort of mitigating that is in the individual context of Randy and Julie, Julie does break up with him for arbitrary reasons and they were already together. So it is more of a, It's not like, you know, she was never interested in the first place. I mean, although I know that's not an excuse. I know that's not an excuse. There are plenty of like shitty relationships where the guy should leave well enough alone. But in the individual
context, you're right. There's a difference because they do have an established relationship and he's trying to figure out how far to push it to get her back. And there's a big difference between that. And in a lot of movies where it's, oh, I want to ask out this girl who I don't know. And the advice is never, ever, ever give up. And it's like, Don't listen to that.
Give up. There is a very appropriate place to give up, and that's why they say no.
Yep. Exactly. And let's be real, this is based on Romeo and Juliet. As fates go, theirs is a lot sunnier here than in the original. Yeah.
although, Romeo and Juliet, it all climaxes at the prom.
Yes.
Where again, Randy, not taking no for an answer, makes his big play to win his prom queen from the prom king. This is, I feel like, you know, every teen movie climaxes at the prom. But again, just like everything, they just do it with such charm.
Well, didn't we all in those days?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, I went to the emotionally disturbed prom, but that's a story for another time. And yeah, it ends with this really, really lovely note of Randy winning his Juliet, and then they're in the back seat of a limousine.
By punching the shit out of Michael Bowen.
Yeah, exactly. And it's very The Graduate, and I think, you know, in a lot of ways you'd be like, wow, that's kind of wrong and heretical to try and swagger jack one of, you know, an iconic movie of that level. But I feel like Valley Girl earns that, and it owns that by being, you know, a really great movie.
I think that ending is great, and here's why. In the world of this movie, this is like their world, you know, this is it seems so important when you're in a young love and a young relationship and she dumped him and he won her back and there was a fight and it's all just, you know, bigger than life, larger than life emotions and everything. And I think that at the last minute, I think Martha Coolidge went, you know what, they're going to be broken up within 6 months. So let's throw in that Graduate ending. It's a bit cynical and I kind of like it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it pays, you know, it pays respect to the complications of teen romance and that feeling when you are a teenager of like your first big love being your entire world and not really knowing and acknowledging that that's not really going to last. Like those kinds of like candles that burn twice as bright, burn half as long and that kind of stuff. So I did appreciate that there is that odd sense of Graduate-like melancholy, but it is also underscored by that Melt With You song again, which I think is a good way to bring up the music, which, by the way, the soundtrack of this, which I didn't even realize, in the parlance of their times, is, like, so bitchin'.
Yeah. Again, I thought, like, this is one of those movies where the music is so important and so central that it exists for a soundtrack, and then for legal reasons or licensing reasons, they never actually released a full-on soundtrack until decades later. They just, like, had, like, a mini one. And yeah, this is one of those movies where it's a rock and roll movie, you know, it has a rock and roll soul. Nicolas Cage, one of the things that I find him fascinating as a performer is that he's a rocker. You know, that's been like a huge part of his persona from the very beginning. I was thinking about this, about the fact that like one thing he makes a big deal of for a lot of his characters is to really, really underline that they like these obscure acts, Elvis Presley and the Beatles. If you guys know the Rock, he like goes out of his way to be like, oh man, I really gotta listen to the Beatles on vinyl. You know, and he channels Elvis Presley in a lot of his performances. There's just the essence of rock.
It's kind of a verbal swagger, right?
Yeah, and there's like a laid back laconicism to him, not to be confused with Matthew McConaughey, but yeah,
no, there's a definite Elvis quality to him, and there's also some fantastic live performances in here that we haven't really talked about.
Oh yeah,
sort of a new wave, sort of one hit wonder named Josie Cotton has a song called "Johnny, Are You Queer." That is fucking great. If you have not heard it, it's really weird and interesting, and the gender and sex politics are so interesting for the time in which it was released. And then the Plimsolls also perform. This is just a movie that its heartbeat is a drum beat. You know,
am I crazy, or is this like the John Hughes film right before John Hughes hit?
I guess a little bit in that it's driven so much by music. And there is
and it's like the caste system of teenagers, and it's written with a bit of sensitivity and the focus on new wave music. I always thought that this had that John Hughes took a little bit of love from Valley Girl.
It's kind of a West Coast John Hughes kind of vibe to it. Yeah. And especially like that Psychedelic Furs song, I think the one that ends up in Call Me By Your Name is in here too, twice. It made me want to dance like Armie Hammer. It was fun.
Oh, Martha Coolidge is a really interesting filmmaker, and that she has made three legitimately great motion pictures and a bunch of other stuff.
Still working.
Those three great pictures being this, Valley Girl, and then Real Genius, which is another thing where you kind of have a teen sex romp written by, you know, Pat Proft and Neil Israel, not the most sensitive dudes in the world. And because she directed it with such sensitivity, with such care, with such a feel for human behavior, it's a great movie, and it transcends its origins, and you know, it's something that people love. And then
if you want to see what a director really brings to a project, just think about if Real Genius had been directed by any of the other, like the guys who would go on to do Police Academy, like you said, Pat Proft, Neil Israel, it would have Real Genius would have been just another, you know, farty, horny college comedy.
Yeah, it was directed by a dude. Yeah, it would have
I think Martha Coolidge and Amy Heckerling, who directed Fast Times, which is just to for history's sake, I have to throw it in. Technically, Nicolas Cage's first appearance.
Right,
Does he speak? I don't know if he has any lines.
I don't think that he does.
But he is definitely in Fast Times. So Nicolas Cage has the really cool distinction of his first two films were by female directors in a male-dominated subgenre.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. And then the final great film that Martha Coolidge
made, Out to Sea, right?
Rambling Rose.
Ah, with Laura Dern.
Nobody was better at sexualizing the leads in Wild at Heart than Martha Coolidge, with, of course, the exception of David Lynch. And that is such a lovely, lovely movie. Again, a wonderful portrait of female sexuality that is not judgmental, that is, just loving and pure and just a great coming-of-age story. So, she made some really wonderful movies. And then this was shot by Frederick Elms. Like, my God, this is a gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous movie. It cost almost nothing, and it's just beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. This is a dude who went on to direct, or shoot rather, Blue Velvet and River's Edge and Wild at Heart, perhaps not coincidentally, in a couple of years. So this
I was struck by that as well, Nate. The technical merits of the film are high quality for an indie film of this approximate era. I thought it was, and it's what I learned as an independent filmmaker, and I always knew, I always kind of suspected, but I never really knew until I helped make films, which is when your budget is super low, you cannot replace a good DP or a good sound. You cannot; those things are what make your movie a real movie, a good look and good sound. And I just was more than once taken aback by just not showy or flashy, but just very handsomely shot.
Yeah, and he does a lot of Jim Jarmusch stuff too. It's really, really good stuff. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you right now, since this is your inaugural episode, I'll give you some advice. Come up with a standardized rating system now, because You'll be like, by episode four, you'll be like, B plus. Wait, you were going on a 5-star scale. Now we're going B plus?
Oh, yeah. No, we're going pure bracket system. Like, this is like head to head, one movie wins.
Oh, wow.
Oh, and we're
okay.
We're doing cage match.
Yeah, okay.
Cage match. Towards the end there, yeah. Where you will be asked to say which one of these movies is.
Yeah, well, I've seen, probably like both you guys, I've seen dozens of movies that were made in the 80s, involve teens and sex. And this one is one of the very best. It's unassuming. It doesn't think it's reinventing the wheel, but it's written and directed with some actual heart. And like I said before, sincerity. It's not like ha-ha funny, but it's cute funny. And like being able to watch it as a cultural relic for clothes and music and just attitude. I think it's one of the best movies of 1983.
Agreed. If there was one article of clothing from this movie that you would want more than anything, what would it be?
I would want Nicolas Cage's Tangerine Dream t-shirt. In part because he's like, oh, you like that techno rock crap.
And
I'm like, wait, he's supposed to be a punk and a new waver and a nihilist, and he likes Tangerine Dream, which is a fantastic band, but you know, not the rockinest. I think one of the
I don't think that the Venn diagram between like the Ramones and Tangerine Dream would be like him talking about like
it's two circles, yeah,
right? Like, yo, you like Vangelis or what?
But you know, I like that. He contains multitudes, and I think it's part of that soft side that he doesn't really reveal.
Or it's just a costume designer who handed him a shirt, and neither of them understood the phrase, and they went, "Cool."
Yeah, that sounds like rocking. Yep. I think I would probably go for whatever the hell their health store is named, but they have the coolest yellow t-shirts. The parents.
Well, for me, the thing that's unique about Valley Girl is that Nicolas Cage was a complete original at the time. Like, he'd come to have such a persona and such an image and become, you know, kind of this figure of fun, this figure of ridiculous self-caricature. So it was kind of fascinating to go back to a time when he was just this explosive, original, sexy, weird, interesting new presence, and not this weirdo that we have been living with. And
oh man, you're in for a
and
treat.
Tolerating for the next 37 years.
Your next several episodes are Rumblefish, Racing with the Moon, The Cotton Club, and Birdie.
Oh man, like no idea.
His performances are. I'm not going to say what you might think about each of those films, but he's fascinating in every one of them.
I personally can't wait for our blowout Raising Arizona episode. Like, because those are two of my favorite movies all at once. So, yeah.
Those are both, yeah.
That might be a good segue to another collaboration that Mr. Travolta did with Brian De Palma, a little movie called Carrie.
It's the night of the senior prom. The Bates High School gym is alive with excitement. Everybody is there. Even Carrie White, the girl no one likes.
We're all sorry about this incident, Cassie.
It's Carrie!
And everyone makes fun of her.
Pray, Carrie!
The girl who lives in that creepy house with her crazy mother.
No!
Help the sinning woman see the sin of her days and ways. Show her that if she had remained sinless, the curse of blood would never have come on her.
The girl with the strange power.
If I concentrate hard enough, I can move things.
But tonight, no one will laugh at Carrie.
If you don't have a date for the prom next Friday, would you like to go with me?
She's with the best-looking boy in the senior class.
He's trying to trick me again.
She'll be voted queen of the prom.
You know, I can make sure that you don't hurt Carrie White anymore.
For Carrie, it will be a dream come true. For everyone else, it will be a nightmare. Carrie. A new film by Brian De Palma. Based on the chilling bestseller. Starring Sissy Spacek, Piper Laurie, and introducing John Travolta in his first motion picture role. If you have a taste for terror, you have a date with Carrie.
Would you like to talk about that, Mr. Worthington?
I would, Mr. Rabin. So Carrie is a 1976 film directed by the very stylish, extremely horny Brian De Palma.
Very directed. Aggressively, aggressively directed by the aggressive Brian De Palma.
Growing up, everybody always, you couldn't read about De Palma without seeing Hitchcock in the same sentence. And I remember thinking, growing up, I knew that he had, you know, Hitchcock love. But what I knew is he was horny. Well, Blowout's kind of a little bit less horny, but even that's got some. No, but it's a good point. He's a horny, especially at this point in his career, a very carnally interested filmmaker.
Yeah, and you can see that from the opening minutes of this. And this is based on the novel by Stephen King, adapted by, who adapted
Lawrence
this?
Lawrence D. Cohen.
Yeah, Lawrence D. Cohen, who's largely known for this, but he's adapted like a few other King properties in the meantime. But yeah, it follows.
He did It, the television version.
That's right. So so the film follows Carrie White, played by Sissy Spacek, who's this shy teenager raised by a single mother who's very strict and religious and who hasn't told her about things like, say, menstruation. So naturally, when she gets her first period, in the gym showers, the very cruel other women, the other girls in the class with her, mercilessly mock her, as they often do, because she's creepy Carrie. She's very spooky and very, you know, she's an outsider. And what they don't know, and what Carrie barely is starting to understand, is that she has some telekinetic powers that make her ire particularly dangerous to incur.
Now, this to me is always one of the most interesting points about the movie, is that obviously these girls are being cruel and that's not cool. But could the movie be offering us a simple message that they sense something in her that makes them aggressive towards her, that makes them not like her innately?
Carrie White must be stopped.
They sense the alienness of her in a way. I don't know. You know?
I mean, I don't know. I'm loath to ascribe to that, because then I think you can extend that to like, well, of course they made fun of the nerdy kid. He was going to shoot up the school. And so like, to what extent is it kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy?
Well, I think the message of Carrie is that attractive teenagers are evil.
Yeah.
And I think that is true.
Although not
gym
all
teachers
not,
are real
wait, 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 wait. Not all of them, because I'm going to get my horny out of the way right now.
Hashtag not all teens.
Amy Irving in this movie is very kind, and she's one of the most beautiful young women you will ever see. So there goes, there's my theory.
But she is popular, you know, and she is involved. She helps, part of this weird, you know, toxic, corrupt system that leads, to the destruction of lives. And again, Sissy Spacek's performance is transcendent, is iconic.
Staggering.
And part of it is that her and Piper Laurie were both nominated, right?
Definitely. Yeah. And the fact that she's so short and small, she seems to kind of like shrink into herself. And everybody else seems twice as big as she does. And, you know, she wasn't that young, but she really kind of looks like a 12-year-old. And that kind of vulnerability is so heartbreaking and makes you empathize with her, even if, you know, things take a turn, needless to say.
Yes. Suffice to say, the...
I'm sorry. I interrupted your plot synopsis post-shower scene.
Oh, yes. No, of course. In the wake of that, of all that trauma and everything, everyone gets in trouble for making fun of her so mercilessly. So they decide to get back at Carrie for the horrible crime of being teased by them. And basically,
oh, that's such a rare but palpable high school dynamic.
Oh,
which
definitely.
Is, like the bully, this is all hypothetical, never happened. The bully punches me. The teacher sees me get punched. The teacher pulls me aside, and an hour later, that kid gets punished. Now I'm due for another punishment just because it's a fascinating,
I mean, that's basically Congress for the last 3 years. That's sort of what we've been seeing, you know. So
I said no politics
here.
No politics or I walk.
No, dang it. but anyway, the teens, the youths of the day, concoct a scheme to trick Carrie into going steady with one of the popular kids, Tommy Ross, played by the greatest American hero himself, William Catt.
And that head of hair.
The third greatest actor.
Oh,
that
beautiful.
What would you do for that head of hair? Oh.
Oh, man.
I think that head of hair proved that he was somehow a member of the Bee Gees.
Does that, dude, like, here's the thing.
Gibbs have hair that beautiful.
D- Do men even still have hair like that anymore, naturally? Would that even occur?
There's like a 70s retro chic thing going on.
Or has that been like worked out of our biology by now?
Do we breed it out? Is that what you're
yeah.
saying?
Yeah. I don't think I've seen a hairstyle like William Catt has in this film since 1977 or 78.
Well, I think part of it is that every shot they slather Vaseline on the lens to give it this like incredibly lurid kind of vulgar, pulpy, almost grindhouse feel.
That first scene feels like
also
a
like
softcore
pornography.
Porn.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that first scene in particular feels like it was shot with the not just Vaseline, but like there's like cotton around the outsides of the lens or something.
For sure, well, was a horny motherfucker.
He was a horny motherfucker. So let's talk about John Travolta's introduction to this film, which is
I keep interrupting. Your synopsis. I'm sorry.
Oh, no problem. No problem at all. And again, it's interesting because it's so similar to Nicolas Cage, where the camera itself seems to wolf whistle these beautiful young men. And what's happening is John Travolta as Billy Nolan is riding around in his truck. Is it a truck? Is it a truck or a car?
No, it's like a car. It's like a hot rod kind of thing.
Yeah, I want to just add, I am not a huge Travolta fan, nor am I necessarily a fan of the male figure. But I will say this, if you want to see the image of a beautiful man, John Travolta in this film is like cartoonishly handsome. It's ridiculous how good looking he is. So if you're like young and you look at John Travolta as just this beefy older guy and you're like, well, I don't see the appeal. How did he ever become a movie star? Watch this movie and you'll see.
He was ridiculously sexually attractive and he's introduced with his girlfriend. And again, this is like Valley Girl where he is objectified as much, if not more, than Nancy Allen. And oh my goodness,
his
is
future
he objectified? There literally there's a shot that is just a close-up of her braless breasts.
Yep.
And it serves a narrative purpose because he's, you know, they're all riding around. They're cruising at night doing, you know, the things that the sexy, cool kids do. And first some bros come by. They're like, hey, go, you know, let's drink some hard stuff. And he's like, yeah. And then he looks at his girlfriend's braless breasts and thinks, no, I've got a better idea than a entire car full of beautiful teenage girls are like, woohoo, woohoo, you're so attractive, you're so attractive. And he's like, oh, yeah, I am. Yeah, you know, whatever. And he's got a fucking beautiful woman riding with him. And
you keep reminding me how great this cast is because Nancy Allen is like the fourth or fifth build. And Betty Buckley. As the teacher, she's phenomenal. I just want to keep. You
I love how much she fucking hates Carrie as much as everyone else.
Totally you know, it is fascinating. It's a really interesting dynamic because you would get.
I was liable to slap her myself.
Right. Yeah, you get the idea that there are these teachers there who have three or four kids every year who are just picked on and victims, and they want to help and they are empathetic. But when the kid turns and walks away, that teacher's a human being who's kind of tired of this crap, also.
Yeah, for sure. So what happened with Travolta? So the police show up and Travolta is drinking a beer that one of his bros totally gave him because that's the kind of guy he does. He drinks and drives at the same time. And even the fucking cops give him a pass, you know, he just like puts the beer down. And then Nancy Ellie's talking to him and they have a horrible, toxic, sadomasochistic dynamic where she calls him stupid shit and then he slaps her. And that's all they do is she calls him a stupid shit. He acts like a stupid shit. He gets really pissed off. And then finally, you know, she's trying to win him over, trying to win him to her side. And she starts to go down on him.
While saying his name, which that's talent.
Exactly. Saying Billy, Billy, Billy. And he's like getting ready. He's like so excited. He's in that zone where the only thing in the world that matters is the pleasure that he's about to experience. And she says, I really, really hate Carrie White. And he goes, what? Or who? And it's so perfect because, again, like, that's how you would be responding in the moment. Like,
it's just great
so
writing,
confused
too.
And, oh, it's, fucking A, man.
It is great writing because it's like everybody knows that this head you're about to get is contingent upon you giving into this plan that I now have hatched while in your lap.
It takes so long, though, that I'm positive that she's supposed to be saying that during.
Yeah. Yeah. She took
that, like,
quick.
She is mid mouth beezy, if you will, and is somehow able to fully form the words Billy, Billy, Billy. Well, I hate Carrie White.
And again, some great storytelling, some great screenwriting here because a great scene. It tells you so much about these characters, what horrible, horrible people they are, what a fucked up relationship they have. But it also pays off narratively in a very direct way. Like, this is where the plan begins, you know? And the other thing that I like about Billy, who I don't like, who's a terrible person, but a really fascinating character, is that he's kind of defined by his sexiness, but also his technical know-how. Like, he's the person who will put the pieces in together, who will help execute this ridiculous plan. And there's kind of a bit of a commonality with this and Blowout.
Interesting thing you made me just think of, that you made me think of, Nathan, sidebar. Mainly Travolta at this point, I guess exclusively, right? Wasn't he just known for Welcome Back, Kotter, in which he is an adorable lunkhead? Everybody, you know, Barbarino is just an adorable character. He's very easy to like. In this, he is not only written, but really playing the evil with the evil leer and stares and glowering. He's a good actor in this movie. And I wonder if it was part of the, not only is, you know, De Palma a hot young, and this is a hot young adaptation of a, or a hot adaptation of a hot young author, blah, blah, blah. I wonder if part of it was he's so evil, you have to play him after Barbarino.
Yeah, I wonder.
Well, and it's interesting to me too, because I feel like there is he could be like a cousin of the character that he plays in Saturday Night Fever, who similarly is so incredibly sexy and charismatic and dynamic and a horrible human being. You know, somebody who hits women, who swears women, who's a fucking sociopath. So I think people, they kind of misremember him as playing more sympathetic characters than he actually did, because, you know, Grease and Welcome Back, Kotter were so huge and were so iconic.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it's also tough to sort of talk too much about Travolta in this, because he is very much a supporting character, but he is sort of indicative of that. He's sort of the villain of this, where, you know, the other kids have varying degrees of sympathy for, or at least hesitancy toward the plan, which, by the way, I didn't get around to saying the plan is to fool, is to get Tommy Ross to take Carrie to the prom. They'll rig it so that she's prom queen, and then they dump pig's blood on her as the ultimate prank.
That old gag.
Yeah, the old chestnut. It's like just like swallowing goldfish and stuffing yourself into a phone booth.
Now I gotta wash all this pig's blood off me.
We all went through that phase in high school. We all had our wedgie, our half Nelsons, our pig's blood at prom moments.
What's your policy on spoilers on this fine show here?
Oh, I mean, this movie is older than most of our audience, so you better have seen it.
Okay,
it's on Netflix if you haven't.
Can we talk a little bit about, because it's always fascinated me, and I've seen this movie 5 or 6 times, and spoiler, I love it.
Oh, it's great.
What is the arc of the Tommy Ross character? He's not in on it. He's not part of the scheme.
Yeah.
Well, that's one of the things I wrote about in my piece, is that this sort of is on the verge of being She's All That. And William Capp plays it with this very interesting level of ambiguity, where he does seem to be seeing her as a human being. There's also the fact that Sissy Spacek is fucking gorgeous. She's really, really beautiful, and this is not an encouraging sign.
I
found myself thinking, wow, Carrie's handling this a lot better than I would in this situation. She's actually less socially awkward than I am.
I love that it's not... It's not played for that kind of kitschy, breathtakingly beautiful. The audience notices, yes, she is breathtakingly beautiful, but it doesn't have that kind of cornball moment where anybody else kind of takes notice.
Well, there's
and
also
I like
kind
that.
Of, there's also like the aggressive, bitchy sexiness of the popular girls. And we talked about the cast. I mean, fucking PJ
Nancy
Souls
Allen
is
and PJ,
in this.
PJ
and she doesn't
Souls.
Have anything to do, but, you know, just by being here and beating PJ Souls.
She has a
awesome.
Little bit, she has more to do in Halloween than she does here, but PJ Souls just kind of brings that freewheeling kind of party girl, whether she's kind of nice like in Halloween or kind of not like in this, but she just kind of, she throws that party girl vibe in whichever direction she needs to. And she also does in Stripes, as a matter of fact.
Right. And I think one thing that sort of mitigates the sort of She's All That-ing of Carrie White is that we know where her problems come from, and it's this terrifying, traumatic home life, and those scenes with Piper Laurie are so good. I mean, this is a comeback role for Piper Laurie, and she's so fantastic as this fanatical, you know, devout, you know, Christian woman who you know, is terrified of sexuality and also has her own traumas as well, as we learn. Like, it's sort of born of her own sort of, you know, sexual assault and all this kind of stuff. And you get this sensation of, like, these cycles of violence perpetuating themselves.
Well, yeah, it's in her eyes, man. It's, I think, yeah. I mean, not only did I grow up loving this Oscar win, because anytime, you know, somebody gets an Oscar nomination for a horror movie, then the horror geeks remember it. Right. And then, and I don't remember, I was way too young, but I don't remember her winning. But you'd look back over 10 years ago, Piper Laurie. So you watch it again and you're like, is it really that good? Yeah. Yeah. It really is that haunted. It's not just that she's evil. It's those moments where she looks like scared.
Something has driven her to this. It's not just like, she's not purely evil. She thinks this is the best way to control her daughter and keep her safe, because she knows how scary the world is. But that just drives her further into madness. And then especially it's all exacerbated by these powers, which manifest themselves in, you know, we mentioned that Brian De Palma likes Hitchcock a little bit. I think that may not be any clearer than the musical cues for when Carrie uses her telekinetic powers.
Also, maybe the high school here is Bates High.
Yes, also true.
And on the first entry in the IMDb trivia is that Nancy Allen claims she never realized her character was going to be so evil until she saw the finished film. So she and John Travolta were playing such self-centered, bickering morons that they thought they were there for comic relief. Piper Laurie also thought the character of Margaret White was so over the top that the film had to be a comedy. And I think that's
to me, that's interesting. Tone, that speaks to De Palma's talent, in my opinion.
Well, it's a testament to his sense of tone, where like this is a very almost like giallo kind of outre sensibility, where it is over the top and there's a lot of big emotions. It's not subtle at all, but that's part of the mood of it, right? It asks audiences to accept that and roll with it, and so with those big emotions comes a big reward.
Right. And there's always an interesting element of who are we identifying with, because I feel like, you know, we have an inherent tendency to identify, to sympathize with the main character, especially if they're bullied, especially if they're vulnerable. But she's such an other, you know, she is such ultimately a monster, that again, that kind of, you know, we keep seeing things through different ways. Miss Buckley, or character played by Betty Buckley, Miss Collins, played by Betty Buckley. Again, that's another weird, interesting way of seeing the story, through somebody who can be sympathetic and not sympathetic to all of these different people. Yeah. And yeah, there's this...
Who, by the way, she was only 2 years older than most of the actresses playing her students.
Yeah.
I have a little sidebar that you guys might find interesting. I was been working on a project for a while, and it's about what I call the Misfit Strikes Back movies. And this is not, Carrie is not the first. I don't know what the exact first is, but Willard uses this template as well. And the template is a slightly or very odd person is bullied by the powers that be and life in general, gains some sort of power, and then gets their revenge on all the people who made their life miserable. So there's Willard, Laser Blast, there's this, Evil Speak, Massacre at Central High, and the subgenre still goes on. And I think this might be the best example of that premise.
Yeah, very, very true. Yeah. I mean, it's also just hard to like talk about this, because this is such a classic and it's been bandied about so much. So there's not really like a lot of extra scholarship we can provide. So maybe it's best to go back to Travolta too. Because we get the scenes where like he and the friends sneak in to like kill the pig, and he has this like incredible glee about him. Like he really, you know, sinks his teeth into the bad guy role here.
It was like what you said before is, you can get a lot of good character beats out of a good directing or good performances, which is some of them seem reluctant at certain points in this plan. And Travolta never seems reluctant. He is the...
He carries the momentum of this terrible plan because he's such a shitheel, which makes his inevitable demise ever better. And also, maybe the scene where he and Nancy Allen die is the better indicator that it's a dark comedy.
So did we establish, is William Catt not in on it, and then he gets hit on the head with the bucket, and then what happens to him?
I don't know.
You assume that he dies when the whole thing goes up in the flames.
He died in the fire, right?
And another kind of interesting thing about the climax is that John Travolta and Nancy Ellen are actually outside of the auditorium, like literally on the outside, and they have an opportunity to escape. But yeah, obviously that's no longer an option. And there's this wonderful turn in Sissy Spacek where the uncertainty, the fear, the doubt all goes out, and it's replaced by pure rage, like pure vengeance. Like any humanity, any vulnerability, any powerlessness that might have existed within this girl has been replaced by this complete sense of awful, awful purpose. And she literally, you know, descends into the bowels of hell, you know. And we talked about, you know, Hitchcock. I think this is very analogous to Psycho, which is another portrayal of somebody who is a monster and a victim and a predator and prey all at the same time, and is so endlessly fascinating that we never stop telling the story or rewatching this. There's just a timelessness to it. That is stunning.
I think that ties exactly into my Misfit Strikes Back theory, which is if the template is somebody who feels out of place is beleaguered by mean people, and then that person wins the lottery or finds a weapon or gets a secret power and fights back, that's just simply a story that appeals to us, period.
But the moment where John Travolta dies, though, I can't help but I can never still take that shot seriously of them just like spinning Nancy Allen and John Travolta in the shot as the car, quote unquote, flips over.
Yeah, because that's our brain moment. Says that's a comedy beat.
Yeah,
that's why, right?
Because it's like, whoa, yeah, and then they die.
Also Brian De Palma was a guy who made a lot of dark comedies, he was very good at that.
Point.
It's interesting that people were like horrified right. that he made, you know, Wise Guys, and like, why on earth is he making a comedy, or like Bonfire of the Vanities? And it's like, well, if you see it, a lot of his movies, like, they're dark and they're horrific, but they're also
a body
really
double has a dark,
well.
Very dark sense of humor. Yeah.
He's always able to toe that line to a certain extent, which I find very, very interesting. And then just other than that, like, I think it's a really interesting kind of, tying it back to Valley Girl. Both of these are movies about, you know, the outsiderdom that happens with, you know, peer pressure, like you said, Nathan, and the various like social dynamics of high school and the traumas they can kind of inflict on people and the difficulty people have in acclimating to those.
Also, here's a question. Would you consider showing a movie like this to a kid pre-high school as just an example of, hey, this is an entertaining, scary movie, but what did you learn? What I learned is, don't tease the weird kid. don't, you know what I mean? Like, as nasty as these movies can get, the ultimate message is, leave that kid alone.
True,
true.
I would
like to think that there are gentler ways to
right, and also maybe the motivation shouldn't be don't tease the weird kid because they might rise up and kill you. I would prefer to find a movie where the lesson is don't tease them because
hey, you know what
thing to do.
Let's just take baby steps. All right,
yeah, I guess so.
If we could
fear
teach
is a
kids,
powerful motivator,
right? If we could just use horror films to teach kids to not bully slightly offbeat children, then we'll take the next step after that.
There you go. Well, gradual things. Do we have anything else we want to say about Carrie? I did find it interesting that both of these movies, and maybe this is an ongoing thing for us, is the movies, like Carrie was remade and Valley Girl was going to be remade as recently as a couple of years ago.
It actually was remade with Logan Paul.
No, they pulled it. They pulled it because of Logan Paul.
Right. But I mean, it was made.
They finished making
this film. I think it might be shelved indefinitely.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Because he's the worst person in the world. He's YouTubers are inherently
terrible. Isn't there a...
But he's the dude, I believe,
I had no
who,
idea that there was a remake. Wasn't there also a shelved remake of Heathers?
Yeah, there was a TV show that they kept pushing back because school shootings kept happening. And they're like, this is not the time.
They leaked it out on some like minor thing. Like, let's just get this fucker out there. And then again, I think kind of their idea was, hey, now the trans, and outsider students, they're the bullies now. And it's like, yeah, that's a shitty take. It's a provocative take. And apparently, like, it kind of complicated that by the very end. But
you know what? I could see a good
episodes to get.
No, yeah, I could see a smart writer taking the whole, oh, you know, the formerly marginalized are now the bullies. I could see that being a particularly smart, like, sitcom episode, maybe. Maybe. But not in the premise of an entire series.
Well, you would need to walk the line so...
Right. Yeah. You would have to be very, very careful.
You would, and you'd need smarter writers than this Heather's remake probably had.
Right, right. And but I guess one of the main reasons I'm sad that there's not a Valley Girl remake, that I can't see it, or at least...
just want more Logan Paul movies?
No, because the lead was played by Jessica Roth, who is the lead in the Happy Death Day movies, and I think she's great.
She is very likable.
Anything more to get out of Jessica Roth is better for me.
Well, it also seemed like very confused as to what the subcultures were. It seemed like the subcultures were influencers and YouTubers.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how they're outsiders or interesting. Like, or
influencers make more money than a lot of us do.
It looked very, very bad. But if you're interested, go look up Valley Girl remake trailer and you will be appalled. Also, it's
Logan Paul.
Also, it's mostly just dancing.
Oh, good. I prefer to think it's dancing with no music as opposed to Valley Girl, which is a lot of music.
There we go. There
and
we
less
go.
Dancing.
It says here, it says, I went down the rabbit hole. It says it's a musical adaptation of the 1983 film.
Oh, cool. So the same thing. but Carrie did get a remake released in theaters directed by Kimberly Pierce of Boys Don't Cry.
I like it. I like that remake. I really
did
do.
As well. Yep. I thought Julianne Moore was fantastic. Fantastic is the mother. I thought, the actress who played Carrie was very good as well. Here's actually a question for you. Do you think of Valley Girl as being a feminist film?
Interesting. I think for its time, I think it slyly is. In the reasons that you said, where it is very positive and non-judgmental about, young women taking agency in their own, sort of social and sexual lives, in that respect. So I think that's cool. I think maybe some of the Nick Cage stuff doesn't really hold up as well. I mean, I think in context it reads as romantic, but definitely like I wouldn't tell like any sons I had to like do what he does. But yeah,
I think it definitely is. I think it's something that is just innate when you have like a smart woman as your director. Is that a scene that might be written as kind of maybe garish or slipshod on the page, she might say, you know what? I don't want my female lead to deal with that. And I'm going to, rewrite it and shoot it in a way that, doesn't make her a victim or an accessory. She's, a character. And I don't think it's like banging a drum feministic, but I think it's definitely a feminist comedy. And I respect it for that.
Oh, definitely. You talked about Fast Times at Ridgemont High as being like one of the rare instances where you try to capture the emotional truth of what it's like to be a teenager. I feel like another very simpatico movie for this is Clueless, which is also about a really smart, really interesting girl who has a wonderful relationship with her father, who also, appears to be a little bit fizzy, a little bit dizzy, but also is really fucking smart. And the idea that just because somebody talks with slang and is very stylish doesn't mean that they're stupid or that they don't have integrity or that, they're not substantive human beings.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's what makes me know. That's what makes me tell that Martha Coolidge is smart, because these are characters who are both very steeped in like iconography, very steeped in being, a part of a what's the word, like identifiable group, part of a subculture.
Subculture, yeah.
Yeah, but they're not ciphers. They're not conformists. They're not idiots, like you said. The Valley Girl slang might sound silly, but they're not dumb girls.
Yeah, it's just a subcultural affectation. I think there is especially looking back now, more than a little bit of misogyny inherent in our judgment of Valley Girls, too, where the impression is that they seem ditzy and airheaded and flighty and emotional the way that like a lot of women are stereotyped as. And it's a very easy way to pigeonhole these people.
The entire Valley Girl thing, just came from, oh, they're, you know, 15-year-old white, rich, entitled kids, and it's an easy way for us to dismiss
right, and blast them for being entitled too.
And like, blast them for being entitled. And it's like, hey, you know what? If you're a 15-year-old born into money, that's not like you didn't do anything wrong, like yet. You know what I mean? Like, it's not your fault.
Oh, right, right,
well,
right.
Well, and I'm like going back and listening to the Valley Girl song that Frank Zappa wrote for his 14-year-old daughter. Like, it's so fucking snarky, and it's so mean-spirited, and it's so empty, and it's just like, for sure, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, again, it's not
a three-minute-long sneer.
Exactly. It's not fun to, like, punch down. It's not fun to, like, take on easy targets. It's not funny. It's just kind of this empty experience.
You get the impression that he wrote that song after he got stuck behind 3 15-year-olds at the supermarket for 15 minutes. And he's like, those damn girls. And then he went home and wrote, what did they say? Totally. And gag me. And for sure. Well, I'm going to write this song. Take that, 15-year-olds.
It's not like they're passing legislation and doing hate crimes. Like, they're maybe just a little annoying.
Well, they have the same title, but the Martha Coolidge film and the Frank Zappa song have opposite spirits, antithetical spirits. One is very kind and warm and loving and acknowledges and celebrates humanity. The other is just kind of fucking mean.
Yeah, exactly.
And one has endured, the other has not.
So it's a good example of what was like a cultural sneer was reappropriated by smart writer and director.
Exactly. And so that's why Valley Girl is super great. With that in mind, then, do we want to move on to Cage Match? Because I feel like we're pretty decided on, like, well, this is actually going to be kind of tough because, I mean, Carrie is a horror classic. And by the way, I'm getting ahead of myself. We're moving on to the part of our podcast we're calling Cage Match. Cage Match! Where we weigh the two films we're talking about and figure out which one...
But wait, we got to figure out a way to get Travolta in there. It can't be just Cage Match. How about Cage Volt? Cage Voltage.
Well, on our Patreon, we have two tiers on our Patreon that are roughly the same amount, where if you pledge at one level, you get, what is it?
Oh, okay. So if you pledge $5.01 a month, you're casting for Cage, your vote. And you're $4.99 a month, you're for Travolta. Got it.
Yeah. Where it's like, what was it? Because it's like $5 for one, $6 for another.
Yeah, Travolta cheaper, you know, because you know, Cage has such an advantage.
Missing out on all those single dollars.
Instead, I did the opposite. Which,
yes, you again, fool.
Helps contribute to Cage taking fool. A very, very big early lead.
Patreon.com/CageTravolta.
Travolta Cage.
Yeah. Sorry.
Anyway, so on to Cage Match. Which movie is better, Valley Girl or Carrie? This is a very difficult question because Carrie is a horror classic. Valley Girl is an unexpectedly sweet comedy.
And you know what? I take it seriously because not only are they both very good films, but you're going to have so many lopsided battles in this podcast going forward that I think that when you get the rare battle royale, that the voters take it seriously.
For sure. And maybe this is another question, too, is do we weigh the roles of our respective subjects as well?
Right. Or is the question, how much does that actor contribute to the film?
Perhaps. I think that's a factor, at least. Whereas Carrie is an absolute classic, Travolta doesn't make as much of an impression in it
Cage of course
does
not.
In Valley Girl.
Yep. It's not a John Travolta figure. He's very good. He has a very important role in it. But this is, you know, a breakout movie for Nicolas Cage, and I'm going to go with Valley Girl. I loved it the first time that I saw it. Probably the second time I saw it, and I loved it even more this time around. It's just a transcendently sweet, beautifully observed romantic comedy that's also like a really clever social satire, and I really, really like Carrie, but for some reason this time around Valley Girl just had a bigger hold on my emotions.
I think we also just need a little bit more like positivity in our lives right now, and I think there's something inherently nice about Valley Girl.
Let me go second so that you can break the tie, okay, Clint, because I agree with everything that Nathan said about Valley Girl. I had duly forgotten about how charming and mature, and again, to use the word, sincere it is, that it likes its characters, that they may occasionally be silly and childish, but they like these characters. The writers and the director like these characters, and that is worth its weight in gold, especially in a subgenre in which the characters are Kleenex, usually. They're just disposable junk. So if you were to dip your toe into 80s teen sex comedies and choose five, Valley Girl would be on that list. I really like it. Having said that, my vote goes to Carrie because it is that iconic. It is that memorable. It is that scary. Not just the two lead performances, but everybody all the way down to Travolta is really fantastic. I think it looks like a million bucks. And it scared the living hell out of me as a kid. And that will probably just be that little extra percentage point that gives it my vote.
That's totally fair. Oh man. So now I'm left breaking the tie. It's really, really tough because I do kind of think objectively, at least in terms of influence and style and stuff, Carrie might be the better motion picture, but I think I may have to put my thumb on the scales here and play the metagame, if you will, because I don't want to be talking in future rounds about Billy Nolan as opposed to, you know, Randy in Valley Girl, at least in terms of this grander evaluation of these two actors and their particular roles. So I think I'm going to have to throw it to Valley Girl.
That's great. I like the logic because if your logic is they're both really good films that I enjoyed rediscovering, but the onus of the show is on these two actors. So then the next weight on the scale is what do these two actors bring to it? And Cage is a co-lead. And yeah. So, you know, therein lies the logic. I get it.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, congratulations, Valley Girl, for making our first sort of win in the Travolta Cage canon. I'm very proud of you, Martha Coolidge, Nicolas Cage, et al. Does anyone else have anything they want to say about this one?
Woohoo! Good job, Travolta, Nicolas Cage.
We will ride off onto the highway to melt with you.
I'm now going to dig into this rabbit hole, and I'm going to find this Valley Girl remake. It's out there somewhere, Nathan. You are. I read a lot of movie nerds. I listen to a lot of podcasts, and you are a guy who turns me on to weird stuff more than just about anybody. I pride myself on knowing a lot about this unreleased so and so, but I didn't know anything about this one.
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
Mae Whitman's in it.
Yeah, yeah, and Chloe Bennett from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. It's interesting.
Oh God.
Yeah, a lot of folks. And plus Logan Paul.
Can we get into this for 30 seconds and then cut it if you want?
Sure.
Imagine this. Imagine you're Jessica Roth, Chloe Bennett, Mae Whitman, and Peyton List is also in this movie. And Josh Whitehouse. All right. So they're all standing around on set waiting for, you know, they're all young professionals. They've all worked on 10 movies or three, four TV series by now. They're all pros. And then the, like, first AD comes in and says, the executive producers wanted us to put somebody in like four scenes because they think it'll help us bring in a certain YouTube crowd. Oh, okay. No problem. Who's that going to be? Logan Paul.
Yeah.
All of those actors, all of those young actors now go back to their trailers and call their agents and say, this movie is never going to get released. And if it does get released, we're going to be ridiculed for being in a movie with this fucking idiot.
Yes, if it gets released, shame on us, really.
And if it doesn't, then we worked on something that is now unreleasable because of this idiot. And, you know, I'm not saying, oh, you know, but I kind of empathize with those actors.
Yeah, for sure. They didn't ask for this.
Exactly. And I can guarantee you, of those four actors or five actors that I just named, two of them called the producers and said, I fucking told you this would get buried if you put that moron in four scenes.
Yeah, for sure. All right, but yeah, let's close out with talking about a little Travolta and Cage news. What is up with them lately, Nathan?
Well, John Travolta does not have any spanking brand new trailers, but Nicolas Cage has a pair of them. One of which looks very, very good and very exciting. It looks kind of in the same vein as Mandy, you know, kind of your crazy cult. It's a H.P. Lovecraft adaptation directed by Richard Stanley.
Yes.
Who's a fascinating figure who directed a movie called Hardware and then became famous for getting fired from the Island of Dr. Moreau.
Yeah.
That was like his baby, and then he became even more famous for Hanging On, because he just like wanted to be around Marlon Brando, as we all do. So if I'm not mistaken, he went and was one of the mutant animals.
He like snuck onto the set. There's a whole documentary about it that's very fascinating.
Yeah, apparently they were all on drugs. I totally need to watch.
that looks
fucking great. And yeah, that looks really, really good.
It's called Color Out of Space.
Color Out of Space, yes. And then there's
another. Scott, you've seen it, right?
I have seen Color Out of Space. Like many horror fans, I am a big fan of H.P. Lovecraft's fiction. Not so much the man himself, but I do like a lot of his stories. And this is an adaptation of Color Out of Space, which is one of the earliest examples you'll find of true sci-fi horror, in that it's about a meteor that lands on a family farm and does unpleasant things. I'll just leave it at that. I saw it at Fantastic Fest last month, and it's fun. I don't know if it goes into that Mandy level of transcendent weirdness, brilliance, like that kind of thing. It is a bit more conventional as a sci-fi horror film, but it does occasionally get into some weirdness. Cage does get a little bit cagey. On the cagey meter, I'd give him like a 7. He doesn't go like, he's not like a 10 would be like Port of Call, you know, or Mandy. But I'm a little bit biased because to me, a half decent Lovecraft adaptation is a great Lovecraft adaptation.
And that's rare too. There's not a great track record.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm not going to overhype it, but I definitely like Color Out of Space, and I think sci-fi horror fans and Cage fans will do.
Yeah. I imagine Nicolas Cage plus purple lighting invites a lot of Mandy comparisons.
Oh, and a great performance by Jolie Richardson, worth mentioning.
Oh yeah. She's in that. Event Horizon.
Tommy Chong is on that as well.
Yep.
Yes.
I think it's an and credit. This is the only time I've ever had this thought. I thought, wow, Tommy Chong looks like he's going to be great in that movie.
Right.
I want to keep some things a surprise, but Tommy Chong does contribute a couple of scenes that are very good.
Nice, nice. And what's the other one?
The one that looks god fucking awful in the same way that so many of his late period direct-to-video movies. It's called Grand Isle, which is a young father is charged for murder and must prove his innocence through recalling a very twisted and dark night of events. He's got a shitbag beard. He's got a shitbag mustache.
Who seems to be his nemesis in the trailer, Nathan?
Kelsey Grammer?
Yeah. Yes, maybe. Countrified Kelsey Grammer.
He has a balding mullet, which again, maybe an indication that this character is a bit of a scuzzbag.
Shrimp and grits all over my face. What is a boy to do?
And he has the southern accent where he sounds like he's got peanut butter in his mouth. Peanut butter and banana in his mouth. Like Elvis on Quaaludes, basically.
Well, and also, no shit. It looks like the return of Cameron Poe, right?
Yeah.
With the tank top and the stringy hair and the accent, like I half expected him to to put the bunny back in the box.
And the only other name actor is Kelsey Grammer as Detective Jones. So I'm guessing this movie will be fucking terrible, hopefully in a very entertaining, distinctive way.
There's like the two levels. It's not even good or bad. It's like Grand Isle and then Color Out of Space, which is like Grand Isle looks like what? Like back when we were kids, it would have been Grand Isle looks like ABC movie of the week, Wednesday night, made for network television. And then you get something like Mandy or Mom and Dad, and you're like, now that's what I want.
Right. I think one interesting aspect to this experiment we're doing throughout the whole podcast is to see, especially in the case of Cage, how different filmmakers modulate and work with his particular brand of crazy. Because I think some filmmakers know how to use it better than others.
Oh, yeah. Well, you'll get into that real soon. Really, you're going to love Racing with the Moon. You're going to love it.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
I remember watching Peggy Sue Got Married when I was 10 years old, or maybe 9 years old, which is very weird because it's such a movie about memory and growing older.
Saw it in the movies, saw it in the theaters with my mom and didn't love it. Still don't really love it, but
I remember thinking, why am I
seeing this with my mom? Why?
Well, I remember thinking too, like, who is this lunatic who brings like all of this crazy energy that doesn't.
Remember? Do you remember? I don't want to steal the thunder from 9 episodes hence, but do you remember how frequently it was talked about, his nasal whine in that film? Like, it was a punchline for a while.
People were horrified. They're like, who is this lunatic that Francis Ford Coppola only put in his movies because he's his nephew? I
believe Kathleen Turner even had said in an interview that I didn't understand what he was doing with that with that nasal whine.
In the decades ahead, many people would not understand what he was doing. That's kind of the mark of a Nicolas Cage performance.
That's true. That's part of why we love him.
Right, right. But on the Travolta end of the spectrum, he doesn't have any movies coming out now. But yeah, award season is on the rise. And apparently there is no shit, a concerted effort, at least on the part of the producers and publicists, to get him to be considered for Best Actor for The Fanatic.
Oh, stop.
Yeah, somebody shared... Somebody shared this to my Facebook page, Society for the Toleration of Nathan Rabin. It says, for your consideration, The Fanatic. And here are the four quotes. One can understand the draw of The Fanatic for someone like Mr. Travolta. It calls for full immersion, mentally and physically, and... ellipses. He pulls it off. And the great thing about those ellipses is there could be anything before that.
I always love to...
And then he pulls it off.
I love to imagine that whatever is in the ellipses was ignore what comes next.
Yeah, basically. And then you have genuine chills and some very black comedy from San Francisco Chronicle. John Travolta nails it in this movie. His acting transcends the written word, which is like, true. And that watching it, I had a hard time finding written words to describe how insane and terrible his performance was.
No, you know what that is? It's like when a parent who doesn't understand what you do, who like just saw your play and you ask them how it was, and they're like, it was interesting.
Yep.
I cannot describe it.
Look, I am... If you were to say this performance in a B movie or a direct-to-video movie, for example, if you were to say I'm starting a campaign to get Nicolas Cage nominated for Mandy, I would be the first one to throw you my axe. I'm in. I am, like, to legitimize lower-budget films that aren't generally considered reputable, I am 100% on that tip. Having said that, Travolta's performance in The Fanatic is... disgusting.
It's insulting. Yeah.
It's disgusting. It is. It is embarrassingly misguided. And I don't know what the fuck he was thinking. It was, if I had an autistic cousin, for example, I'd want to punch Travolta in the face. I want to punch him on behalf of autistic people that I've met in the past. I think it's embarrassing. That's how bad I think that performance is.
But also the element of gay panic that they introduce at the very end adds a whole new element of awfulness and offensiveness. Yep. This idea of like, oh, he's so childlike and autistic and insane that he's gay and he can't express his gay love for this. I'm like, oh, please, you started from a bad place and you're just making it worse.
You're just writing yourself into the toilet. It's terrible.
Yeah, exactly.
By the way, I did want to remind your listeners that that documentary that you mentioned is called Lost Soul.
Yes, it's very good.
It's excellent. It's called Lost Soul, The Doomed Journey of Richard Stanley's Island of Dr. Moreau. But all you have to remember is Lost Soul. And it's not about a sneaker. It's S-O-U-L.
Yeah, that wraps it up pretty much for this episode of Travolta slash Cage or Travolta Cage. I don't even know how we're deciding to call it.
Travolta slash Cage.
Travolta slash Cage.
What if you were to call it Cage, Travolta versus Cage, The Face-Off?
No, because it needs to evoke the title of Face-Off. Like Nip Tuck.
Yes, you're right. Yours is better. I wasn't picturing the slash.
But anyway, yeah, Scott, thank you so much for joining us. This is a blast as always. Tell the people once again where they can find your stuff.
Oh, I write for Thrillist and Crooked Marquee. I also have a Patreon. It's patreon.com/Scott E. Weinberg. I do a lot of sci-fi related stuff on there. Right now, I would love it if you would check out a podcast that I co-host with my friend Stephen DeGennaro called Science versus Fiction. We just posted our 11th episode. Yay! So we're like, once you've done like 10 episodes, you're a real podcast. And we've had some really interesting guests where we're like kind of pairing up specialists with certain films. So we had the awesome Jess Phoenix, a volcanologist slash geologist, and with her we discussed Dante's Peak and Volcano, and then like I said, we had an actual epidemiologist on and we discussed Outbreak and Contagion. Just a lot of fun. We really enjoy it. So check that out. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Travolta Cage. If you want to support us, go to patreon.com/Travolta Cage. If you want to email us questions, because we're going to still try to do like listener questions and everything, email us at TravoltaCagePod@gmail.com. It's a much more manageable email address to enter than our previous one.
I have a question as if to show an example to your listeners how questions work. What film from each actor that you haven't seen are you looking forward to doing on the show?
Ooh, that's a good question. Nathan, what about you?
I'm going to choose two weird random ones because I'm kind of excited about seeing the obscure junk as I am the masterpieces and the terrible, terrible motion pictures. Firebirds for Nicolas Cage.
It's like 88, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I have the female lead is Sean Young. And
Tommy Lee Jones?
Yeah, but I'm fascinated by that because it just seems so off-brand for Nicolas Cage. And it was kind of right before he had, you know, sort
his
of
action run
comeback. He always has like, yeah, he always has these comebacks because he's always making so many terrible movies. And then for Travolta, Two of a Kind.
Oh,
it just seems like something that I should have seen that I've written about for my World of Flops. But
I was just going to say, how does that not cross your desk on Flops?
Oh my goodness. Yeah, but I'm definitely going to write
it. Is bad in the kind of bad that you love to write about.
For Cage, I'm trying to think of like ones I haven't seen that I'm actually really interested in seeing. I guess I haven't seen Wild at Heart, so that'll be really fun to watch.
Dude, yeah. That is great. I envy you. I envy you for having like to see it for the first time. Don't read too much about it. Just kind of take it as an avant-garde film noir. That's it.
For sure. And I guess if I had to pick one for Travolta, I don't think I've actually seen Get Shorty.
Oh, same. Well, not the same type of movie, but I envy you. It's so much fun. It is a lot of fun.
Like, I've seen Lucky Numbers and I haven't seen Get Shorty. Like,
underrated movie, Lucky Numbers.
Really? Yeah.
I kind of liked it.
I haven't revisited it since I was a kid. I did not know any better.
Adam Resnick's screenplay. Talented guy. Yeah.
Well, there we go. So, yes. Once again, thank you for listening to Travolta Cage. If you want to support us, please go to our Patreon at patreon.com/TravoltaCage. Be sure to email us listener questions at TravoltaCagePod@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter at TravoltaCage. Our podcast logo is by Felipe Sobrero. Our podcast theme is by the lovely John Began. And Nathan, what are we doing next episode?
Next episode, we got The Boy in the Plastic Bubble, the legendary television movie vehicle for John Travolta, and a motion picture called Rumblefish.
Yes,
Francis Ford Coppola's legendary high school noir.
Rather fond of that one.
Yeah, very, very vivid, very evocative motion picture. And I want to close things out on a classy and dignified way, saying it's great talking to you, and I need to go poo.